being an artist, being a Buddhist, and an activist. Followed by our own chance to do some mindful drawing.
Thank you.
So let me introduce Michelle. Michelle,
could you? Which is easier than it sounds.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So Michelle, tell me first of all then, how did you get into Buddhism? Tell us your journey into Buddhism.
Thank you for having me. It starts quite a long time ago, back in 1992, when I went over to Asia travelling, like you do, and was completely taken by...
I'm just wondering if there's something... Keep talking, okay. I'll fiddle around.
Okay, I'll turn you on a bit more. So I was really taken by the monks in Thailand, in particular, and started reading a bit about Buddhism, and then I came back to Brighton in 1993 and went to what was then the FWBO in Park Crescent and learned how to meditate there. So I was there for a little while, and as I was just saying, I was a bit of a flaky Buddhist. I still am a bit of a flaky Buddhist. And I went to, had a good friend who took me off to the Bodhisattva Center, and because she was very involved with them, and I listened to some of their talks but didn't think that was quite for me. And then I kind of was just doing things on my own, and I became unwell. I had a long-term ailment, really, that sort of knocked me for six for about a year and a half. And during that time, another good friend said, "Why don't you come with me to an ashram down in Hampshire, and you know, see what that does for you, because it's very heart-opening."
What's an ashram?
An ashram is a meditation centre or a spiritual centre with a guru at the head of it. And I'm supposed to be showing you some slides. Let me just get this to work. It's been on sleep. So this was the guru, this is the guru, Gurumayi Chipalasananda. She's head of Siddha Yoga, and they used to have a big ashram down in Hampshire. And I went there, and I got really into this. It's very much a devotional practice from the heart, and lots of chanting, lots of meditation, lots of amazing Indian food, and so the whole kind of thing was quite sort of loving, and it did help me to through that period, and then after a few years, things have changed in my life. A lot of things changed in my life, and I was better, and I went off to India as part for part of my degree studies. And I was looking at Indian temple sculpture and whether that was collected in this country. And within that sort of journey of doing that, I realised actually I didn't. When I got back to Brighton, the path that I thought I was going to go on, which had something to do with computers, I really didn't want to do that, and I wanted to get more into yoga, because following the guru had got me into Hatha Yoga. So I came back to England, finished my degree, went off to India and trained to be a yoga teacher. And so within all of that, I kind of lost my spiritual guide. I was finding my, what then became my career as a yoga teacher for the last, since 2000, but I lost my sort of spiritual direction. And so when I came back to Brighton then, having done that training, in 2000, I moved into a shared house with Richard and Vashi, these two friends of mine, and what we had in common is we'd all been to India a lot. And Richard had just set up the Bodhi Garden, which was some of you will know it, was a Buddhist centre in the Lanes that was a centre that all different groups could go and hold their evenings there, or meetings there. And so what came from that is we had monks and nuns and Dharma teachers staying at our house, so I was having breakfast with all these Buddhists, you know, like all the time. And so I kept, you know, I thought, well, I've got Buddhism, you know, in the morning as soon as I get up, I've got somebody here with quite often a really deep conversation going on over the porridge, you know. And I still was kind of sort of pushing it away a bit, thinking I don't know what I want. And you know, we had Christopher Titmuss, we had Robert Bayer, we had Martine Batchelor, we had all these amazing teachers staying at our house. And one of those monastics was Bhante Bodhidharma. And he was sitting on our sofa. He used to stay and do his retreats here. And he was sitting on the sofa, and he was sitting back, and he said, "Michelle, one day, you know, don't stop searching. The teacher's just going to sit, you know, just going to appear in front of you." And I was sitting on the sofa thinking, okay. Mm-hmm. And then went off and did his retreat with him the next day. And before I knew it, I was down at Guy House with him doing a Vipassana course. And that was 20 years ago, and I still carry on with his teaching now. So the meditation that I'm going to attempt to lead in a little while is, I'm just going to show you a picture of him actually. There he is. So that's Bhante Bodhidharma. This is his centre in called Satipanya, which is in Shropshire. I met him when he was at Gaia House, but then he was already fundraising to set up his own centre. So he teaches in the Mahasi tradition, which is a Theravadan tradition. And I mean, what's different about the Mahasi technique, because it is a technique, is that you have a noting word when you meditate and you do everything in really slow motion. So we're going to have a little bit of a go at that later on. But otherwise, it's kind of, it's straightforward. And he's just a really straightforward teacher, which is, so he explained the Dharma so well, and he's just about to retire. So I'm introducing him to you as he steps down as being the main teacher.
And you could replace
teacher.
Him.
he has some good people in line, but yeah. He is one of those teachers, you know, when you get a gem and you just think, somebody who can just explain things so brilliantly. Yeah. So I think that's probably my journey into Buddhism.
Yes, thank you for that.
And I realise I have my notes all in the wrong order.
And art, then, when did you get into art? Because your first degree was...
My first degree was visual culture, so I was looking at other people's art, criticising it, and writing about it, and doing a bit of art history and cultural studies. And I really wanted to be an artist, but I hadn't done the right things in life to be going on and doing that. So I was a frustrated artist, I suppose. But I did the Artist's Way as a book. I'd carted this book all around India on my when I was training to be a yoga teacher. And ended up sending it back to Brighton, not wanting to just leave it and give it. I thought, I'm going to do this thing. And I eventually did it. And it got me into just doing a little bit of writing my lists and doing my artist dates. And we used to teach at Catherine, didn't we? It just spurred me on to go to Brighton Tech, the Met, to do a pre-foundation course, so 1 day a week course in art, which is fantastic. And at the same time, I did a foundation course in counselling at the Gestalt Centre in London, because Richard, my housemate, who was then my partner, he had just done this training, and I just thought, God, this is amazing, I need to do this. So I was up there doing that and doing the art. And at the end, I was applying to be a psychotherapist and applying to do the foundation in art and just thinking, I just don't know which way to go. So within Gestalt practice, there's chair work, which some of you might know, where you have two chairs and you sit in the different chairs and talk to different parts of yourself. So I had my psychotherapy want to be and my artist want to be, and I did my chair work. And the psychotherapist was all very excited and all very interested, but the artist was in floods of tears, just going, oh, I need to do this. So I thought, okay, that's really quite clear. I'll go and do the art. So I did the foundation, thinking, oh, it'll just be a foundation. I'm going to go and do the course, I'm going to make huge, great metal sculptures, because I was really, for some reason, really into that kind of thing. And I got to college and I was terrified of the tool room. You know, I just didn't want to use saws. I didn't want to use anything welding. I was like, no, I can't do it. But my tutor just said, well, you know, take heart. You know, actually, you've got a real thing with colour going on here. And just hone your skills in what's already a strength, which is not something I was used to doing. I always wanted to fight against that and do the thing that was a real challenge. So I listened to him and... ended up just going into painting, and it's kind of progressed since then, really. And so to begin with, I was really interested in abstract art, and I still love abstract art now, but to start with, I was interested in the connection with Zen. So all the abstract expressionists had a connection with, a lot of them had a connection with Zen, and making these dynamic marks and calligraphy, and trying to get, I was trying to get something to do with stillness and movement, and you know, which, and I mean, now I know more, I realise actually that's what all the abstract expressionists wanted to do, and I was just, you know, trying to do that and trying to invent the wheel, really. So I did this course at the V&A with these really big brushes, doing, Zen calligraphy on the ground. You make these lovely big marks on newspaper with this gorgeous ink. You're making these lovely Japanese symbols, and then they dry, you fold them up and throw them away. And it was just great. Just that sense of like you take all the care, you've done really mindfully, and then you just throw it away. And then eventually you keep one if you want to. But the whole thing was to not be precious about it. And hopefully that's the kind of attitude we'll take to some mindful drawing later on, just having a go at it and not being precious about it. So this painting, these two paintings showing you here, tea ceremony paintings. Once I was trying to find a way to bring spiritual or meditative practices into art. So I was looking at the way we could do something with a calligraphy brush, and also looking at tea ceremonies, the idea that, you know, there's a presence and a meditative quality to those. So I did a whole series of these paintings. And alongside the abstract expressionist, the St. Ives artists from this country, they have there's a real crossover between those artists from the 1950s and the abstract expressionists from the 1950s in New York. And so I was interested in both of these. So I was going to St. Ives for holidays and just sort of taking in what I can. And this was my one of the better paintings that I made as my kind of take on that kind of artwork, I suppose, to try and capture something still of the Zen. There's lots of ensos, lots of circles made with Zen. And so I was trying to do that in paint, which is not as easy as ink. And also to get something of the sea, to get something of the wateriness and the light. And then I was really fortunate that I was teaching yoga up at Unit 4, which is just up Ditchling Road, and Pete Blackaby, who owned the place, said, "Oh, why don't you make something for that wall there? That was one of those sort of like hatches through into another room, and they just got a board on it." He said, "Just do anything." So that was my kind of first commission, and I fretted and fretted over this because I taught in that room. I still do teach in that room, and I was really concerned that if I made something that I was going to look at and go, oh, all the time, every time I saw it, then that was going to be really off-putting for me to teach. And also very off-putting for the students to sort of have to have something that was jarring. But I also didn't want anything that was too insipid and would just fade into the wall. So it's got a lot of different paintings underneath it where I just couldn't get it right. And eventually, this is what it's ended up with. And because of the way this sort of section kind of looked like a socket with a ball in it, which is just how it's happened. I wasn't kind of really planning it. I decided I'd call it acetabulum, which is at the hip socket, because Unit 4 is a yoga studio that really focuses quite a lot on the skeleton and physiology. So I felt really like it really helped develop my art practice, having this commission, site specific. You know, if I had to do it to that size, it had to be durable, it's got loads of varnish on it, in case people were putting their hands and feet on it. So it kind of really sort of bumped me along the way. So that was a really lovely step for me. And then this painting, this actually comes quite a lot later, but I thought it made sense to put it here, because this was the painting that that Bodhidharma, when he was visiting, he always visited in May, And I was always doing an open house in May, so I'd got all my art all over the place, and he would always be chatting about it to me. And he just got, he'd had Flatipani for a few years, and he just made an extension, and I knew he needed something for the wall, so I offered to make a painting, and he said, oh, that'd be really nice. And nothing really came of it. And then the next time I saw him, he said, oh yeah, by the way, I've had an idea for you for the brief, for the painting. What I'd really like is for you to paint the moment the Buddha was enlightened. And I, yeah, exactly. Thanks very much for that, yeah. So I said, oh, right, okay, you do know what my work's like. So I started Googling, you know, and looking at, you know, what is it about the Buddha's enlightenment that I can perhaps use as a way of making an abstract painting. And there's a lot of stuff on Wikipedia about the moment of enlightenment and the aura. And the aura being, as it sort of says up there, the aura was five colours, and that's the colours that everybody uses for their prayer flags all across the Buddhist world. And as those colours emanated from his body, apparently it turned silvery. And so, I can use those. I started mixing all the colours together, and if you mix enough white in, you can get a silvery colour to come eventually. So I used orange as the base for Theravada, the oldest form of Buddhism, and Satipanya is the Theravadan tradition. If they don't wear orange, but I like the orange. I called it Prabhashvara, which is the Sanskrit word, and Satipanya only used Pali, and I realised I'd made that mistake afterwards. I've sent it to him with the name. But it means the same thing. So I sent him a little description, and he showed it to various different students who were up there, and they seemed to think that they accepted it as kind of an okay interpretation.
That doesn't do justice to it though, does it? I mean, the original was fantastic.
It really doesn't actually.
No, it doesn't.
You can see, I hadn't realised the colour was wrong. It's much darker on my...
And on the WhatsApp group.
That's going to be a problem with the coloured ones, actually. Yeah. I don't know how... I don't think I can do anything about that.
No, people can see both, though.
You can see them all here, yeah.
But it is beautiful.
Yeah, thank
Absolutely
you.
Beautiful.
It's not very big, that one. It's about 60 centimetres. I am kind of known for painting some really big paintings, but that's only about this big.
Yeah.
So... I've got a lot more paintings and things to show you, but should we stop and do a little meditation now and maybe have a comfort break? Is that a good time, do you think?
Yes, I think it's a good time, yes. For the meditation first and then a little comfort break afterwards, if that's all right. And so it'll be a particular style that you're leading.
I am going to attempt to lead you through Mahasi technique. Now, so there's three elements to the Mahasi technique. The obvious one is mindfulness of breathing, which you know. And then there's the noting technique. And then there's the going really slowly. So the only way I can really give you an experience of going really slowly here is if we stand up and do some walking meditation. So should we do that? Should we stand up? And it might be better if you just find a little way where you can walk four or five, you only need four or five steps, but you're going to do it in ultra slow motion, like you're watching something on freeze frame. So you don't need very, very much. You could even walk around your mat, up to you. So if you find, and then we'll stand, we'll do some gentle move, we'll do this gentle or slow movement, and then we'll stop and we'll turn around and we'll walk in the other direction. We'll do that for just probably 5 minutes, and then we'll very ever so slowly sit back down and do about 5 minutes sitting down meditation. Does that sound all right?
Mm-hmm.
So start by standing and feeling your feet. Bring your attention down into your feet. Feeling how your body's gently moving,
balancing, feeling the weight, the warmth of the ground. So this noting technique is to harness the mind and to prevent the mind from wandering. That's the purpose of the noting. So the noting is just a word as a label. So a little bit like how when a child is first learning to learning words, they might say bird, 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 without really having a sense of anything other than the word. So really you're just using a noting word to stop yourself going into thinking a narrative, really. So if you, with your attention down on your feet, have the intention to move, so you put your weight through one foot, and so having a sense of pressure, maybe you could use the word pressure, and then lifting a foot when you're ready, so you could use the word rising, lifting, moving as that foot moves forward, and falling, or dropping, or standing, any kind of word that works for you. When you're ready, you let the other foot begin to lift. Gently swing the leg forwards and place it. And so on. So you're being aware of your feet touching the ground, being aware of that intention that comes to move, before the movement happens, feeling the movement. If you feel really wobbly, then have a wider stance. You don't have to do it with eyes closed. Relaxing into it, feeling it. Tending to move, moving, placing, and then come to stillness again. And we're going to turn around. So have the intention to turn. Feel where that movement comes from in your body. And begin to turn, lifting, moving, placing. So using the noting word to note what you sense in your body, if the mind is going to thinking, note thinking, stillness again. Feeling the feet steady on the ground. And then for us to sit back down, have the intention to move, still move slowly, and get yourself back on the ground, move your cushion, whatever you need to do, just as slowly as you can. And notice if you have that urge to just do things quickly. And so you can feel that pull to, that might be me, that sense of wanting to move quickly. Just feeling the being here, moving really slowly. Settling into your ordinary meditation posture. Bring your focus to your belly, feeling the rise and fall of your belly as you breathe. This is something that the Mahasi was that always taught, that if we focus on the breath at the belly, then we're kind of getting the awareness out of the head and we're getting more into bodily sensations. So feeling the belly rising, falling, using the noting word rising and falling. But you can use other words if they suit you better. And then at that gap, at the end of the out-breath, if there is a gap, using a word like touching or pressure, feeling hands touching the body or the your backside on the cushion. So we're using the noting word to stop the mind from wandering. You can say the word as many times as you like. Bodhidharma always teaches it by saying it twice: rising, rising, falling, falling, touching, touching. When the mind wanders, recognize what it's doing, note it, thinking, worrying, feeling, whatever it might be, and notice where you feel it in your body. When you feel somewhat settled on the breath, allow whatever draws your attention to be felt and observed in the same way, noting whatever draws
your attention, for instance, if it's a sound, noting hearing, and focus on the sensation of hearing, rather than a narrative connected to the sound. Feeling and observing anything that draws your attention. See that everything is arising of its own accord, not under your control. Sensations, feelings, emotions, moods arise and pass away, whether you want them to or not. Thoughts and imaginings draw you away, whether you want to go away or not. As you note, feel and observe, can you sense the distance, the separation between the observer, the feeler and knower, and the experiencer from what it is that's being experienced?
Thank you, Michelle. So, if anyone wants just a leg stretch now, loo break, and chance to ask a few questions before we go on to the second part. Feel free. Minute leg stretch. A couple of minutes leg stretch. Yeah. That was really nice.
A little bit different.
Could have gone on for longer. Any questions for Michelle? Thank you.
using with these?
Acrylic, mostly. Actually, I think most of the ones I've shown you, apart from the ones that were kind of calligraphy pieces, they are ink and ink and oil. Most of them are acrylic. I tend to use a particular medium, such as acrylic, and then when I get stuck, which I get stuck a lot, then I'll switch and start using oil, just because the different medium means I've got to work differently, and it sometimes is enough to push me through the block. So I often end up shifting from one to another. And you can't do it the other way around. If you've started in oil, you can't shift to acrylic.
Mm.
So it's kind of safer in a way to start with acrylic, and then I can always shift to oil if it goes wrong.
Is this one all acrylic?
That one is, yeah, that's acrylic. It's actually got some sand in it as well. It started out as one painting that had sand in it, and then the painting didn't work, and so it sat there for a little while, and I thought, right, okay, I know what I'm going to do with it now, paint it differently.
What was underneath that?
It's acrylic. It was based on a photograph of the ground, of the tile, paving in Italy. I've really taken by the pavement in Italy, and I was taking lots of photographs of it, and then I would use it to make sort of compositions for painting. But that's got nothing to do with that.
No, it's kind of intriguing,
and
there's something else hiding under.
Yeah, there's something hiding under. There isn't a lot of them, actually. Paintings don't, not very rarely do they just come out kind of in sort of one kind of linear way for me. They stop and start, and they don't work, and then I start using a particular set of colours, and then the next time I come to the studio, my mood is so different that those colours are I just can't work with them. I have to completely paint it for it in different colours. That happens less so now, but it happened for a long time. That happened a lot. So paintings have got lots of different layers of colours where I'm just flitting around, not sure what I'm doing.
How do you know where to stop?
I don't know that I always get that right. I think sometimes you kind of, yeah, I take photographs of paintings in different stages, and I've got quite quick energy, so which is why the slow practice really suits me, because I can just do things quickly, and then sometimes I'll just, it just needs a bit of, and I've sloshed something on and then gone, oh, that really was not the best thing to have done. And you either got to try and get it off, or you just got to live with that and paint over it or work with it. So knowing when to stop is, you can stop too soon as well, and then get really scared of like not being able to do anything else to it. You know, it becomes scared of the painting. So it's being able to break through that and think, no, I'm going to paint something and I'm just going to get it to happen again, because paintings work better when you're bold, really, and you have the courage to push through. And it's amazing how kind of fearful you can become. You're going to mess it up, you know, and yet you mess it up by being fearful. So it's a bit of a loop.
Mm. Mm. Are we waiting for someone else?
No.
Thank you, Michelle. That was lovely. I'd like to have sat there for a little bit longer, but we have questions to go on. So that was your art with Buddhism, but you've changed your style more recently.
Yeah, I've got a few pictures, because I had a sort of a long transition, really. So this painting was actually before the one for Bodhidharma. This is actually, as an abstract painting, this is a painting of a yoga mat. This is a like a love letter to a yoga mat, really. So I've got one of those really old pale blue yoga mat that I've had since the mid-90s, and it's well used, and I don't like it if somebody stands on it. And so I painted a picture of it, and it's, the pink kind of blotches around it kind of almost represented sort of like rose petals scattered around my yoga mat, which never happens, but I just like the idea of it. And it's called Sweet Sweet Love, which is named after a Gorgi psychotic monkey song, which I played a lot when I was painting it. So some of the titles of my painting are a bit random. They're not very, not always deep and meaningful. And I've just kind of given you a picture of the gallery where I had an exhibition to give you a sense of scale, because I do like to work at almost like the same size as me. It's kind of, there's something really physical about that sort of moving and sort of having to sort of move and really energise yourself with the paint.
Colours are amazing on there.
On your screen, yeah. It's very faded up there.
Still beautiful.
It's a bit cheaper than that. And very, very bright green. These paintings, they relate sort of to meditation rather than sort of Buddhism as such. These were a lockdown series. I painted during lockdown. We had not long moved out of central Brighton up to Bevendene, so we live really near the Downs now. And so we were really fortunate during lockdown to just be able to walk on the Downs in a quite a deserted part of the Downs as well. So I could walk through meadows and be alone. So I was feeling rather blessed about that, to have that sense of space. And everything was abundant with wildflowers. It was all quite new to me because I hadn't lived there very long. And so I was walking through these little arches of trees and things. So this painting is kind of a fantasy of that kind of thing, really. Obviously, there wasn't flowers of that kind of colour up on the Downs, not quite in that kind of mass. But this bridge I kind of saw as a kind of almost like a portal. I was kind of going out of the house, out of listening to the awful news and awful Boris Johnson on the telly, and then going into the Downs and walking through these little portals into these fields and meadows, and just thinking, wow, this is great. Meanwhile, you know, not being able to visit family and, you know, sick father and things. So I was kind of really a bit torn as I made these paintings. They're all based on the Downs. Sorry, they're not very colourful up there. I had this thing going on during the lockdown in that I had a solo show booked for the autumn, and I had to make the work not knowing whether the show would happen, because I didn't know whether we'd be in lockdown or not. So I was just going into the studio and just making things, thinking, well, I'm probably nobody seeing it anyway. So I was just experimenting. So this isn't oil painting. This is oil right from the very first layer all the way through, which I've just said I don't do very often because of the mistakes. But I just thought, I'm going to just try it, you know, because it's not something I normally do. So some of them were more muted and smaller, more of a sort of square size, just trying to have a sense of calm and stillness, but also trying to get some colours. And then this is a different series. So from the walking on the Downs, I was reminding me of walking as a child with my grandma, and I'm from Suffolk, but Suffolk and the South Downs share chalk as their sort of base, so all the flowers and everything were all the same. And so I was reading a lot about ancestry and sort of connections to the earth and things. So when I could go up to Suffolk, sort of after the lockdowns, I went with my brother and sister to Grimes Graves, which is a flint mine, Neolithic flint mine, really close to where my parents live. And I thought, well, I could use this, like really deep in the earth, I use this as a sort of subject to make some paintings. And we went down this mine that's owned by English Heritage. And it's like going down a really big well. That steps down, and it's all completely white, apart from a couple of seams of flint. And so I thought, you know, I was thinking about it, and I'll make lots of really white, chalky paintings. Actually, what I ended up making was loads of black paintings. And, you know, it just happens like that with art, really. It's sort of, kind of have an intention, and then actually it just doesn't turn out the way you sort of think it's going to happen. So I ended up making these kind of quite scratchy black paintings, as a kind of response to the chalk and the flint. And I made a lot of them. I've just got two or three of them here. Two of them. Yeah, okay, that's the next series. I'm going to have to come out of this and just go back. Okay. So when I was making this series, I was already thinking, you know, I've got myself boxed into a way of working and I need to try and change it. And I wasn't finding a way to do that. So this was my kind of last series of making work where I do lots of research and field trips and various other, and I make all the work and then people can't interpret it in the way that I want to, with the message that I've kind of researched, because you can't read it in the work. So I thought, I've got to change the way I make artwork. I've got to make it more figurative, or something's got to change. So didn't know how to do that. So I'd always got an exhibition or an art fair or something lined up. So I was just fortunate enough that at that time, a mentoring program called Turks Bananas had set themselves up in Hastings, come down from London. And I thought, fantastic, I'd known about these for years. I thought, I can get to Hastings and do this course. So I enrolled myself on this 2-year mentoring program in order to sort of like shift this thing that I was doing over there to a different direction. So I was, because I was very distressed about what was happening in Palestine. I was really kind of wanting to make some kind of social comment in my artwork, and I just thought, I just don't know how to do it. So it gave me time to think about what to do. So I started going back to family and history again, and I grew up next to Lake Heath Air Base in Suffolk, as in very next door to it. My parents just grew up in that village. We used to play right along the fence as a child. So I was looking for photographs. I found this photograph. It's me outside of a Electric Lightning, which is a British plane, taken when I was about 3 or 4, my mum thinks. Not sure where it is. It's not at Lake Heath, but it's obviously, my dad thought he would take me to an air show when we were on holiday somewhere in Suffolk. So I think that's the earliest picture I've got of me. Well, it is the earliest picture I've got for me of a plane. So as a child, we've got fighter planes coming over the house, spy planes, great big cargo planes. They just fly all over the place up there. There's two big air bases really near each other, American-occupied, rather, air bases. And I quite enjoyed it. Kids, it's a deprived area. There's nothing to do up there. So I'll look at the planes, go to air shows. So everybody's kind of buying the propaganda, really. But as an adult going back to visit my family, I saw it in quite a different light. And I moved to Brighton when I was 19. So I kind of moved, when I was going back, I was always a bit sort of concerned about what was going on their doorstep. But to sort of bring this into my work, The Guardian printed something about the fact that there was going to be nuclear weapons stationed at Lake and Heath again. It was in the Cold War. In 2023, they wrote this article. So I kind of thought, well, this can be my angle. So that's where I've kind of directed my work now. So I've made a series of paintings called Background Noise, which so in the bottom up, you've got kind of children playing on a playing field with the planes and the fences sort of overhead. So I've made a series of that kind of thing. So what I wanted to try and do is try and get something across about how we are, how we just take it as normal, when actually it's really quite abnormal to have these kind of things going on. But when you live near them, you just get kind of slowly boiled into believing it's okay. This is another one of the same thing, really, a children's playground on the side here. This was made after I'd kind of gone home for Christmas and walked along the fence and just thought, yeah, you know, this is really not all right. What can I say about this? And then looking at my my Instagram, like doom scrolling on my Instagram, which was like war, 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 cats doing silly things, oh, cats doing silly things, war, cats doing silly things.
Mine.
And I just thought, well, this is my, this is what I go to get away from all of the horrors that I'm looking at. I look at cats doing silly things. And I kind of think, well, that's how I kind of numb myself. But I am looking. And I started going to think, well, how can I get other people to look? Can I put something fluffy in the paintings to get people to go, oh, look, cat, oh, what's that? And to try and draw people in. So that's my kind of, that's my sort of method I'm using at the moment. I've moved from cats to rabbits, as you'll kind of see. But then I started painting the planes themselves. So these are really big. These are 2 meters wide. And I wanted to paint them in that loose kind of sort of abstracted kind of style. But I've painted quite a lot of these, and I haven't yet been able to sort of show them all together, but I like the idea of showing these together. These are F-35s, which are the big supersonic missile carrier. They are equipped to carry the nuclear weapons, and the bomb release mechanism that they use are made in Moscow at the L3 Harris factory, so we really ought to be up there protesting about that, I think. So the Americans have a big fleet of these at Lake and Heath, and they fly over my parents' garden most days, and it's grim. It's grim up there.
Where do the planes go to, do you think? Are they just practicing ready, or are they actually going? Or do you not know? Do we not know?
We can track them. There are people who track the planes and where they go. So, unfortunately, of the last year or so, they're going over to the Middle East, and they are from there going to Iran, and they can follow that. They know that. They've also been training Israeli pilots at the base. They know that as well. So it's not good. So we have some peace camps up there now. When I started investigating this subject, I joined CND to find out more what was going on about the nuclear weapons, and found out that there was peace camps about to be held. So I was able to go up to the airbase and outside of the airbase and meet these people who'd set up this peace camp. And it was amazing. They were all women from Green in Common, they were all kind of like older women. There were other people as well, but there was a big crowd of them, and they were so welcoming and taught me a lot, really. And we did some actions and did various different things. And then in 2025, we did this much, much bigger camp for 2 weeks. They asked me to make this, make them a banner. So this is 4 meters wide. That's, you know, it's really probably as wide, almost as wide as the room. I've kind of stayed with this kind of like childlike, sort of naive kind of way of painting to sort of have something of the sort of the childlike view, and using rabbits as a kind of like, oh, rabbits, get in there and have a look at the rabbits, and then find the planes. The clock represents the doomsday clock, which when I painted the painting was set at 90 seconds last year. It's now set at 89 seconds to midnight. It's the closest it's ever been. At the height of the Cold War, it was 2 minutes. So to give us an example of how dodgy we, you know, how scary it is at the moment. And that's the banner sort of in one of the places where they used it in the camp. And this is really recent work. This is 2026. Called these series Accidental Heroes. So the rabbits have now become kind of, possibly they've become activists, maybe, have they? I don't know. Have they just found the tin can and got red paint on them, or did they spray the paint red, the plane red? So I'm trying to be quite, you know, funny and cutesy with them, but I want to try and get some kind of message out there as well. And then here they're quite successfully dismantling a nuclear bomb. They've got the plutonium cone at the end. And they've let the tire down on the plane. So then I've got just a 4 minute film to show you, which I made up at the camp in 2025. And it's basically about making that banner and then showing the camp. So I hope you can hear it.
In August 2023, The Guardian reported that the potential surety mission at RAF Leggeith in Suffolk was thought to refer to the return of nuclear weapons after 15 years. US nuclear weapons were first based in the UK in 1954, notably at RAF Greenham Common and RAF Molesworth, but also at RAF Leggeith, which at one time has shelters to store as many as 110 air-launched B-61 nuclear bombs. This news galvanised me to start making paintings based on my memories of growing up near Leggeith Base, and subsequently to join Leggeith Alliance for Peace, a newly formed umbrella group, to peacefully protest the return of the nukes. For the 2025 Peace Camp, LAP asked me to make a 4-metre backdrop for the camp in the style of one of my paintings. The camp was to be held over a 2-week period at Easter. Rabbits had begun to feature in my work, and it seemed right, with rabbits being an emblem of Easter, to include them on the backdrop. Before there was a base at Leggeith, the land was a huge rabbit warren. The runway was built for the Second World War, with the US taking control of the base in 1948.
Morning, I'm on vigil duty at the base this morning. I'm at the side of the road, waving at the traffic.
People do not like Donald Trump. That's a real moment of opportunity of saying, why have we got Trump's military base under Trump's control right here in the middle of this? Yeah, that's exactly the right reaction. There was a gas to pop, right? That's what we have. And let's make sure people know that. And say they don't want that, because I know they don't want that.
Of huge military weapons, isn't it?
Yeah.
These disaster weapons built should never have been built in the first place.
Yeah.
It's
shocking.
I think the last nuclear weapons were brought back into the country.
Yes. Yes. The thing with the airbase being under US lease is that they don't have to say that there's nuclear weapons back in the country. I mean, I understand they're not going to say we've got nuclear weapons here and advertise that, but they don't have to tell us they're in the country. But, excuse me, there's been a project on at the base, a building project, since
for the last 2 years, where they're building what they call a surety dormitory for 144 beds. And surety, I've written the term down here actually, because I'm not good at remembering facts. Maybe I haven't got the page. You never have the page you want, do you? Oh, yeah. Surety is a term referring to the capability to keep nuclear weapons secure. So they're building they've been building this so-called surety dormitory at Lake and Heath for the last couple of years. So it's, the people who do all the nuke, there's a nuke watch organisation and various other organisations, they're pretty sure they're there now.
And these nuclear weapons, though, I mean, it's not like they're nuclear bombs, they just do incredible amount of damage.
I haven't got that stat actually, but they're B6112 thermonuclear gravity bombs. So I'm not sure of the stats, but it's either 10 times or 100 times bigger than Hiroshima. I think it's more than 10, but I can't remember the.
Is that per nuclear warhead?
Yeah.
That's just one is equal to.
Yeah, one. Yeah.
And those are the bombs that they're making the release mechanisms for at L3 Harrison.
Well, they're making bomb release mechanisms, so I don't know whether the same bomb release mechanism fits all bombs or whether. I'm not sure, but they are made for those planes, and those planes are equipped to carry nuclear weapons, as well as other missiles.
It's not just the capacity of nuclear armed aircraft to fly out of Lake and Heath. By basing nuclear weapons in the United Kingdom, we're making ourselves a target for nuclear attack from the other side.
Yeah.
So it's not just our capacity to harm. Are running grave risks of being targeted ourselves. It's made even worse because at the moment we are actually launching missiles at Moscow from bases in Ukraine, even today, right now. So the potential for an escalation.
When you say we are launching on Moscow, who's we?
Prime Minister Starmer has been supplying missiles to Ukraine called Storm Shadow missiles, which are made here, and can only be properly operated by... they need to be targeted using satellite technology, so they can't really be operated by Ukrainians. And it's more or less admitted that our technicians are operating these missiles. It's quite horrifying, actually, and what's really important is that our media isn't really telling us. It's terrible, yes.
When you blockaded the main gate, did you get any reaction or any confrontation? What was the response from people on the base?
So, LAP, Lake and Heath Alliance for Peace, they coordinate with the police liaison officers. So that they negotiate, they say, we want to do a blockade. And on that one that was on the film, 2025, we had a two-week peace camp. So we had themed days. So each day we did something. And there were various people, XR people and various other people who came and just did some actions that were not in, that the police didn't know about. And arrests were made. So with the blockade, we were encouraging as many people to come as possible, and we negotiated that we would blockade that main gate. There are other gates people can get in and out of, but this is the main one. And we negotiated, we said we wanted to do it for all day, and they gave us, I think it was between midday and like 3 o'clock or something. So we had this time when we could do it. And then just before that time was coming to an end, the police start approaching and saying like, hey, you've got to get off the road or we're going to arrest you. And so then you have a choice to get off the road or be arrested. So most people choose to get off the road. I chose to get off the road. And then there are several people who are just very happy to be arrested. So they just lie down in the road and are arrested. And so that's kind of how it went for that year. And then this year, the Peace Camp was held at Easter again. And the same thing happened. We had a blockade and just a few people decided to be arrested at the end. But this year they also did a secret blockade, which they hadn't told the police about. And they did it after the camp had completely finished and everybody had gone home. Some activists then just completely blocked the front of the gate early in the morning, and they locked on. They took this kind of sculptural thing with them and locked themselves on, about six of them. And at the same time, the other gate, which is sort of like secondary gate, sort of on the other side of the base near the village, a whole load of activists. I don't know who any of these people were. They all seemed really quite young. They were all very masked up. And they just, there was loads of them, they just completely blocked the gate and did an amazing thing. And I don't think hardly any of them were arrested. I don't think. I didn't know them, so I'm not really sure on that. But that got masses of coverage, that particular thing. I think young people are just so brilliant at social media, it just kind of went viral. But that was great. But mostly there's a coordination with the police for most things, so that they're not making, so that people can do these kind of protests and do it reasonably safely. And the reaction from the people, because it's on a main road, this is the other thing, you've got this really busy, fast, you know, straight road in front of it, so cars are racing past. And you get lots of honks for support. You get a few, not so good, but you get a lot of support. And you get people who are trying to turn into the base. So when you have the camp on, we're camping on a piece of like a grass verge, really. I say camping there, we're not camping there. We're just we're having our congregations there, really. They have to camp elsewhere because there's nowhere to camp at the base. It's not like Greenham. There's not a kind of a woodland or anything. So you've got American people coming in and off base, and a lot of them are supportive of the peace campers. They're kind of, they're sort of quite discreetly putting their thumbs up or rolling their windows down and just saying, you know, good job or something. I think there's a lot of them who are kind of not really in agreement with what's actually happening. You know, I don't know. People are aware, but a lot of people are employed by the base. Both my parents worked on the air bases, and they are one of the main employers. It's quite a Suffolk is really, really huge, and it's often seen as quite a wealthy area. But this pocket around Lakenheath is quite bereft of sort of services and transport links and all sorts of things, and there's not great work opportunities up there. So there is a lot of people who work for it, and there's still quite a lot of propaganda, people believing that it's all right, or just putting up with it, and there's not a lot of local people joining the protests, unfortunately. There are some, and there's a big group in Cambridge and in Norwich, but they're big cities that are kind of, you know, away, you know, further away from the base.
I think that's as I find, people still have trust, really, I suppose, in our government. It's trust. And the trust that we need to defend ourselves from baddies, you know. So people do just believe in the status quo. They don't question it, is it? It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's the
trust in war. They'd rather
the defense. Yeah.
Send their 18-year-olds off to war and trust, and then defend. Yes,
there's been two nuclear accidents at Lakenheath. In the past, one in 1956 and one in 1961, both just managed to avoid catastrophe. I've written down what they are because I don't really know them. One was a bomber plane crashed into the nuclear storage area, burst into flames, loads of fuel were around the nuclear weapon. So I mean, it was just a miracle, really. The information I've got here is each of the warheads that were stored there were 10 times greater than the little boy. The little boy was the bomb, the name of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So, and that was in 56. So the ones that they've got now are going to be much, much more powerful than that. Mm-hmm. And then again in 1961, these are both at Lakenheath, these accidents.
a plane that had a hydrogen bomb on board. The pilot accidentally jettisoned the fuel tank and it exploded. Yeah, it just makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah, accidents do happen.
And that was 4.7 times more powerful than the little boy Hiroshima bomb.
Wow.
And both of these incidences were not reported for quite some time. In fact, the second one was not reported until 2003.
Wow.
Because what happens on American territory doesn't really get out into the news. In fact, the Guardian, sort of slightly unrelated, but the Guardian are doing a series of, it's on their front page online anyway, over the last week and a bit, they are leading with a story about American servicemen who have been, they're sexual abuse cases, but they are being, they're being court-martialed in Lakenheath Air Base, where they've been working, rather than by the Cambridgeshire Police, which is where they've been living and where the incidents have happened. I think the Guardian might have something that they're just laying crumbs, and that they are eventually going to, well, I hope anyway, they're eventually going to tell us something more impactful, but you don't know. They're on the case anyway, which is good.
I wanted to ask about you as an activist, because that's how we know each other, because we're both artists and we both kind of do protests and that sort of thing. So it's quite an interesting story. I know bits of it, but my question is, how has becoming an activist impacted you? Because you're a professional artist, you go to art shows and art fairs and sell your paintings.
I did.
Yeah,
that's not working out so well for me anymore. So I think when I kind of sort of made it a shift, I kind of made a decision that making a living from painting, as in selling, like setting up my little shop, if you like, and selling artwork at art fairs and things, wasn't really working for me on my sort of social conscious level, and that maybe I could find other ways of supporting myself, and so that I could make artwork that I could perhaps then sort of show in a more trying to raise awareness of these situations. Certainly the American air bases is my thing that I'm focusing on at the moment.
Are you finding places to show the work, apart from making
Heathrow? I haven't, apart from the banner. I've got an exhibition in November in Cambridge at a gallery that Cambridge Stop the War are actually hosting and putting on for me, so that will be quite nice, I hope. And I then need to follow up on some other leads, because Norwich, I think it might be Norwich CND and Milton Keynes and a few other of the sort of anti-war kind of groups have said I could possibly show work. So I need to see if I can get a bit of funding to take my work around to do those sort of things, because otherwise it's just costly to not be working and go and do these things. So that's what I'm trying to work on.
Of course, social media is probably the biggest way that we're communicating with art nowadays, I guess, Instagram.
I suppose it is, really, yeah. Although only a few people look at that, so there's a lot of people on Instagram, but, there's a lot of people I know who don't go anywhere near it, so it's finding ways to get work shown. I've got a painting in the Phoenix Art Space, my studio is down at Phoenix, and opening on Friday is an exhibition down in the main gallery there. The Phoenix Gallery is 30 years old this month, so they are opening the main gallery to the artists who are resident there, so we've all got, if we wanted to, we've all been invited to put a piece of work in the show. So there is one of the rabbit sabotaging a plane pictures in that. You can see between this weekend and September.
What about locally? Brighton Stop the War.
Brighton Stop the
Palestine
War.
Palestine House.
Palestine House, unfortunately, I have spoken to them. That's a Palestine focused thing, which I get. Yeah. Yeah, it takes them off topic a little bit.
Yes. Mm. Yes. 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 Any more questions?
Can I just point out that when there is a demonstration at L3 Harris, which makes the bomb release mechanisms, Helen and I usually organise a vigil to support the demonstration, which is non-arrestable.
Yes.
But I'm sure Helen will let people know.
Yes, on the Buddhist Action Group. Yes, and we often have Michelle's banner of one of the...
The Stop Elfie Harris, one of the big planes, they asked if they could have one of those printed into a banner. So I did that, and then they had it, and I kind of thought, well, it's really out of context, just a big plane on a banner. It kind of, you know, it could be read in either way. So I got it back off them and wrote No Bombs from Brighton on it, and then it made a bit more sense.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yes, I'll advertise next time we do L3 Harris. Every now and then we have a vigil, a very peaceful vigil. Other activists appreciate it. We have a little bit of a meditation sometimes, don't we? And,
so. There was one time the entire demonstration went into silence for about 20 minutes, along with us.
Any more questions? Fascinating. Maybe we'll continue the conversation as we do our mindfulness drawing exercise. We've got time? Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Is everyone up for a bit of mindfulness drawing?
I'm actually going to go.
I'll just point out that Ruth's also an artist and has done for XR. What's it called? Interfaith XR.
Interfaith exhibition at my church. So I'm also a Christian. And I did a whole series of ecological stages of the cross. So that the kind of suffering that was caused to Jesus is what we're doing to the planet now, which we should be regarding as sacred. So we're in a very strong relationship between what was done then and what's happening now.
Very, very powerful. Thank you.
Are they on show somewhere?
They were we had open house there during the festival. They still are.
Are they on Instagram yet?
I took myself off Instagram.
But they're still in the church?
Yes, they're still in the church. Renunciation.
I'll take pictures and put them on the Buddhist Action Group as well, because they are rather lovely. They're ecological. Yeah, fantastic. Very good.
Are they going to stay there? They're going to stay there for the time being, but I think we're looking at hopefully getting them round into different churches in the area at some point.
Yes, which church is it? It's in Hanover.
It's in Hanover. It's the Church of the Annunciation in Washington Street. Washington Street. If you want to come and see them, we're not open very often. But you can get in touch, and obviously we're open on Sundays from 11 to about 12:30, and then we're open briefly on a Wednesday, two or three times on a Wednesday.
Yes.
But people can get in touch with me on the WhatsApp group, because I'm in the WhatsApp group.
I'll publish the pictures. Plus, you're going to be something with the sea. What are you doing?
The sea blessing.
The blessing of the sea.
Sea blessing on the 16th of August. In the afternoon.
Yes. Which really is quite just a Christian ceremony to apologise to the sea for polluting it. It's very moving. It's a lovely.
And to say thank you.
And to, think,
and to celebrate the fact that there have been some wins in the sea, like the kelp recovery project.
Yes. Great. Thank you. Oh, well, we can still get together and do the mindful drawing.
So this is a very simple little exercise. You've got some paper, haven't you?
I have.
It's blind drawing, basically. It's choosing something to focus on, to draw, might want to focus on something like this. You might want to focus on sit near somebody and focus on somebody else out of the window. It doesn't really matter what you draw, because the thing with what you draw is, I mean, you can keep it if you want, or you know, I might encourage you just to fold it up and throw it away in that kind of Zen way, really, of just doing it as a practice. So you don't need to be precious about it. And you're not going to look at your drawing, your own drawing. You're not going to look at it as you make it. So you're going to put your pencil or pen on the paper, and you're going to look at what you're looking, what you're going to draw, and your eye and your hand are going to move together, nice and slowly around. So if you were drawing a face, for instance, you would have, and you're not going to do any rubbing out. So you might start with drawing an eye, and then you have to come across to the other eye. So you're not, you can lift the pencil if you want and replace it, but you know you're kind of going to be guessing as far as like where things are, and it makes for really interesting drawings, you know, which you'll be surprised at what you end up with. I mean, it might be all over the place, but that's quite interesting. So the thing is in the touch of your pencil, how hard you want to press, or pen, whatever we're using. And then you're just your eye coordinating. Bye, Ruth. So it's your coordination. Yeah. So and you know, it can be, you know, you can make it really small if you like. You can make it bigger. If you can't resist looking, you can have a peek and look away and then come back again. Is that all right?
Mm. Yeah.
Does it matter, pencil or pen?
But it doesn't matter whether you have a pencil or a pen. I've got some coloured pencils.
I'll get those.
This one was used.
Yes, I've got those. So what if we do a 5-minute one, and then we stop and we look at it, and then we have another piece of paper and do another one? Does that sound all right?
So you're
starting, and you're just kind of looking at something, and you're not really too worried about the lines you make, or how big it is, you know, and you just kind of sort of draw it somehow. You know, just double check you don't block the paper and I want you to draw. You know, you might find that your pencil doesn't leave much of a mark in some places, and other places you've got really deep, heavy work. Find you get around the whole thing, you can just start again and redraw on over top.
Is it good?
Quite interesting exercise.
It's a good exercise in just looking. You know, in art they sometimes say, you know, you get your eye in. You know, you get used to really looking at something.